Marsh from Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. When I say welcome back to The Realignment, I am referencing the fact that this is technically an emergency podcast. This is coming out on Friday, February 25th. We recorded this at 4:50 p.m. on February 24th. So insert all the statements about A, events are and will changing over time. B, because we don't have much time to edit, this is going to be pretty direct to camera, pretty straightforward. So apologies for anything there that happens. And just C, I just want to be clear. I kind of am reluctant to use the word emergency because it suggests that we, you and I, Sagar, have these huge stakes that the world is awaiting our take. When it's really just that we have an episode on PayPal coming out on Tuesday, and it feels totally discordant, unmeeting of the moment to just let this go unremarked upon. So we have audience questions. We have our thoughts. How are you feeling, man? That's just a good place to start.
I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, I tweeted about this. I did not believe the U.S. intelligence estimates at all. So, and I want to be clear about what I said by that. When they said things like X amount of troops are around Russia, that's a fact. And that was mostly verified. So I was like, okay, like, I'm not saying that that's not the case. When they were like, there are kill lists, there are plans in order to take Kiev, I was like, this is crazy. I was like, nobody's going to do this in the year 2022. And the reason I thought that is I genuinely thought that this was a posturing exercise by Putin in order to ensure some sort of soft promise that Ukraine would never be a part of NATO, which he got. And maybe some, I thought that the maximal case was total annexation of Donetsk and Luhansk. And this is a full-scale pincer attack, Marshall. I mean, while you and I are talking, there's already been over, like, let's see, 57 Ukrainian soldiers who were killed, something like 350 Russians. They've taken Chernobyl nuclear site. I mean, you have literal missiles slamming into Kiev. It just is complete and total insanity. I mean, there's just no way in order to describe it. It's a total flagrant breakdown of the European order by Putin for not a particularly good reason. And I guess it's a good reminder that some people in geopolitics are not rational whatsoever. And those people almost 99% of the time end up being authoritarian.
And I just want to build on something you said here. Putin actually got every single thing he actually expressly wanted. Someone had a good tweet last night where they listened to my episode of Dmitry, and he said that we were a little too unsympathetic to people who are sympathetic to Putin's claims. And you know what? I can admit there is nuance to the debate around NATO membership. There's nuance to the 90s. There's nuance to the 2000s. But in terms of Putin's actual legitimate concerns, after last weekend, there is no world whatsoever where NATO is going to admit Ukraine.
And they shouldn't. I don't think they should. I've said that on the record.
There was actual near complete consensus, even within the U.S. foreign policy D.C. blob, that that wasn't going to happen. And even if the U.S. did want it, Germany would have vetoed it. So that just was not on the table. Two, huge win for Putin. And once again, this is a Biden policy I support. No U.S. troop commitment to Ukraine. So, for the legitimacy argument around his security and his concerns, everything was answered and he did it anyways. So, I don't know. We'll get to questions in a second. But it's like you said, man, like this, something I think you and I should think about more is what's so frustrating about arguments around neoconservatism and the war in Iraq, that there were so many arguments that were made so improperly and dangerously back then, that when they were made today, it was really easy to discount them.
Yeah, I just didn't.
So I get
it.
Why.
Yeah, that's right.
When people, if you read the books that conservative center right people were saying about Saddam Hussein in 2003, they're saying this is this existential threat, this is this madman, this is this big threat. People say that about Putin. I understand why people have a hard time taking those claims seriously. So I don't know, man. Like it seems vapid. It seems weak, but there's just actual no words for this. And obviously, all of our Jesus almost said thoughts and prayers. And as we know, yeah, that is not allowed. But I don't really know what else we're supposed to say.
No, you just be like, look, it's sad. I don't know what else to say. I mean, that's what I said too about Ukraine. It's terrible. I mean, you see people getting killed. I watch videos of people who are literally getting missiles exploding their homes. I mean, missiles slamming into historic city. And for what? That's the thing I don't really understand. I just think that Putin has dramatically overplayed his hand. There is no way that Russia's economy is nearly as resilient and autarkic as he thinks it is. No way. They import $250 billion a year of goods. They're essentially a gas station in terms of their exports. You can export as much as you want to China. 50% of all of Germany's imports come from Russia. That economic connection is going to be virtually cut off. On top of that, you are now a pariah state in the eyes of the world. You full-scale invaded another country, not Eastern separatists, like actual pincer movements around a country a la the 19th century. You will not win in the eyes of the public. You will not have any real allies on your side, possibly aside from the Chinese. I'm not saying that doesn't matter, but two countries against the rest of the world is not one. Here's the second one.
Quick thing, Sagar. Even the Chinese one is really interesting because you'll notice even the Chinese, when they will say things like Ukraine is not Taiwan. Right. So even in their own specific way, they are making clear that this is sort of like a...
Even they won't fully embrace it because
the Chinese argument is, look, like Taiwan is a part of China. If we go to war with them, it's a civil war. This isn't international aggression. When they say Ukraine is not Taiwan, they are actually saying, look, Putin, like you're invading a sovereign state. You're doing territorial conquest. Even the Chinese are acknowledging this is basically not chill.
Right. And here's the other thing, too. Putin has now ensured geopolitical tension with the West for the next decade, this generation. That's a gigantic loss. He just ensured massive increase in the U.S. military defense budgets, U.S. deployments to the eastern flank of NATO to the tune of tens of thousands of troops. Germany's defense budget is probably going to double this year. France and the U.K. are going to do the exact same thing. The Poles, the Latvians, and the rest of them, no way they're going to take this sitting by. We are now in an era of nuclear geopolitical tension that we haven't been in since 1979. And so I just look at this and I think your domestic economy is failing. This is going to cost a colossal amount of money. I mean, any idea, just right now while you and I are talking, the Ukrainians just barred all men from the age of 18 to 60 from leaving the country, because they intend to mount a full-scale insurgency and they're handing out AK-47s in the Times Square. I have no idea how it'll all work out. Will it like immediately collapse? Maybe. Maybe not. They're a proud people, and now you have to deal with that. You're going to learn the same lesson that we learned in Iraq. You break it, you buy it. Now you have 44 million people in order to maintain under your domain who you forcibly invaded and took over. I've been trying to play with a lot of history here. And Marshall, I'm curious what you think, which is that if you look at the grand sweep of the last two centuries of Russian leaders presiding over failed domestic economies who launch wars of aggression, it's not a good track record. Russo-Japanese 1904 was dealt explicitly in order to try and quell the rising Japanese empire. It turns into a colossal military disaster for the Russians. It ends up basically spelling the demise of the Tsar. Obviously, 1914, the Russians to protect the great Slavic people, all of that ends in the Bolshevik Revolution. Finland, 1939, you and I are just read Andrew Roberts's book, The Second World War. People forget this. Finland was a disaster for Stalin. It was the first invasion of aggression by the Soviet Union in that time, and they lost tens of thousands of people for nothing, and actually still didn't even end up getting exactly what they wanted. And then finally, Afghanistan, 1979. Every single one of those over the last two centuries resulted in failed military situation and in actually really hurting all of the Russian regime at home. So history is not on the side of Vladimir Putin. The world is definitely not on his side. It's a colossally arrogant, foolish move, in my opinion. And look, I mean, I guess my biggest mistake was thinking that he was too smart to do something like this.
And I want to build on something you just said, because you just referenced France, and made me think of, you know, Emmanuel Macron. Mm-hmm. Putin humiliated Macron.
Yes.
Putin humiliated everyone who tried to engage with and treat him in good faith. Everyone may have seen that big picture of Macron and Putin at that big table because of COVID concerns. Macron flew. Macron is on the phone with Putin right now.
He did his best. He tried.
And he's doing his best. Yeah. But Putin humiliated him. And this is like the crazy thing there, which is that Putin has now established a situation where if you engage with him in good faith, you will come out looking like a fool. You won't accomplish your goals. Why would anyone possibly do that? This is the point where I want to start getting to Q&A, because we have never got so many questions so quickly. So I want to get to as many of them as possible. This first one, there's actually a set of good questions here, so I'll pick and choose. Comes from Brooks B. I'll keep people's last names out. If this isn't Hitler in the Sudetenland, what are some historical analogies that we can look to for guidance? I'll start with your answer, Sagar.
I just gave some. Russo-Japanese, 1904. Afghanistan, 1979. Personally, I think that's probably the most apt one in terms of today, which is that what Putin did is he basically, what Brezhnev did in 1979 when they invaded Afghanistan is he just destroyed détente forever.
Can you explain détente?
Détente at the time was the idea that we can live with the Soviet Union, obviously under Richard Nixon, which is that we say, and the Kissinger famous quote is, as long as they stay within there and deal with themselves and don't outwardly expand, whatever. We're not going to deal with it. We accept the two global powers. It, you know, leads to these nuclear treaties, and we lead to a foreign policy in which we can live with the Soviet Union. But then foreign military adventurism with the invasion of Afghanistan invites Ronald Reagan as president of the United States, who then institutes a policy of rollback, which is that we are going to actively work as the United States in order to roll back the USSR's borders and the power projection of the Soviet Union. He has now ensured that will be the default policy in Washington and the West for decades to come. Can you imagine a more foolish move by a Russian leader? I look at it in exactly the same way, which is that the reason that the 79 invasion was launched was to try and shore up support within the Soviet Union, cover up for their failing economy. You know, a war is exactly what the great people need. Great patriotic war, all of that. Colossal military disaster of what, 10 years of that experience invites huge domestic political turmoil, because you have all these people whose sons are getting killed and they can't say anything. Not even the propaganda can hold them back. I look at this as an almost entirely analogous situation.
And look, before I get to the history point, I just keep thinking of ways that before Putin launched this campaign, he'd won. Do you see anyone in DC talking about regime change in Russia?
Yeah, no.
None whatsoever.
Right
now, the move is we punish Putin as much as possible. We punish his clique of oligarchs. But there's no claim of we're going to support the Chechens and they'll overthrow Russia. There's no claim of we're going to see mass protests in the street. They're going to force it from office. No one's even making that claim. It's not the 2000s anymore. There's no belief at all whatsoever that there will be a color revolution that will change his government. So he just really had gotten so much of what he wanted. We left Afghanistan.
Yeah.
We left Afghanistan last year. The US had clearly, and even what's even funny too, is there are plenty of people on the right, center, and left who said, hey, like, we need to pivot away from Europe. Let's focus on what's happening in Asia.
That's still my position, actually.
And guess what? Putin did the worst thing for that argument. He was actually, and this is where, like, once again, like, this is, it's funny, people get this in the domestic context. Having super old leaders who are constitutionally stuck in the past without any actual check on their power is a disaster. It's such a normie, obvious MSNBC take, but it's just true. Having this like 68-year-old person, no offense to any of our older listeners, who is obsessed with Imperial Russia, obsessed with mistakes he thought the Soviet Union made, has been a disaster. But I want to get to the Sudetenland question, because you did a good monologue earlier in the week about the topic of the Putin Hitler comparison, and the thing I agree with you on is, I do not think it is useful to call Putin Hitler. I don't think it's useful to call anybody, basically anyone else, because at the end of the day, there's the joke about everyone gets called a Nazi today, but Putin isn't Hitler at a literal level, but he also isn't on a couple of different levels. Like, no one's claiming he's going to, he's given no indication, unlike Hitler, that he is going to pursue a genocidal campaign across all of Europe. Even in the 1930s, there are clear hints of that being true. Putin isn't that thing. That said, Putin, and this is where the Sudetenland, this is Hitler's initial successful effort to get the West to agree to give up a part of Czechoslovakia to him because he claimed German speakers were being discriminated against. Putin raises similar questions that Hitler's leadership of Nazi Germany raised. I think there were a bunch of people who were very online this week who, if they thought of this conflict through that lens, wouldn't have ended up with eggs on their face. So a couple questions raised by Putin and Germany, the Sudetenland, Ukraine. Okay, when someone threatens violence, if you give them what they want, does that result in peace, or does that actually result in more aggression? Now, that question could go different ways, right? That's why we shouldn't overdo the Munich analogy. It could go a bunch of different ways, different
times. Yeah, sometimes
times,
it actually works.
But it's an actually useful question to ask, and it's a question that comes from Munich. We were talking about this before this episode, but question that comes from the war in Iraq, regardless of what you think about it, the idea of a war of necessity, aka the war in Afghanistan, despite how it turned out, just the idea of, wow, the Afghanistan are literally holding terrorists who have declared war on us, we're going to overthrow the regime. That's a war of necessity. The war in Iraq, that's a war of choice. Moving forward, American precedents and Western leaders should ask themselves, when we are engaging in a military conflict, the following question: is it a war of necessity or is it a war of choice? Biden explicitly said, this is a war of choice. I am sympathetic to the Ukrainians. I don't like Putin. There will be consequences if he chooses to invade, but I am not placing American troops as a tripwire that could escalate. That is what taking a lesson from history would effectively be. I really just think we should reject a lot of folks who just say out of hand, don't talk about this historical event. Like, Sagar, you know, I'm more hawkish than you are. It would be total bullshit if I said, Sagar, no, you can't talk about Iraq. I'm tired of the Iraq analogy. Right. I don't want to hear about it now. I don't want to hear about Kabul falling, Sagar. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Find a different one. What I've just noticed that every single time people have said that aggressively on Twitter, what they've essentially meant by that is the example you're bringing up brings to mind really tough questions that I don't want to answer.
Yeah, I think, and this is always the issue, Marshall, I would say 99% of the people making Sudetenland don't know a goddamn thing about Munich and are unwilling to talk about it in that way and use it as a historical evocation without raising the nuanced question that you pointed to. And I'm not even above it. You know, it's funny, when I were talking, I saw somebody who will remain nameless say that we should roll back NATO in response to what's happening. And look, I literally do not even believe that we should have added the Baltics to the NATO in the first place. That being said, rolling back from your existing treaty obligations in response to the Ukrainian invasion, that's actual appeasement. And that is where
it's like, that's where actually, like, Munich.
Okay. Like, that's, yeah, it's like we're getting close here. And, you know, okay, so like let's continue down the Munich thing. And actually, this is very controversial, but I actually commend Chamberlain and a lot of what the Brits did at the time, because what they did is the useful lesson to all of history. By separating any legitimate grievance that you possibly had, that the Germans could possibly have, from their literal genocidal campaign. And I do think that that was important. So in that context, it was important to acknowledge at the time, which was widespread and is correct, that the Treaty of Versailles was deeply unfair to the Germans, and that you could understand how that unfair treaty led to the rise of Hitler, the collapse of Weimar Germany, and all of this. And then once you arrive then at that point, and then try and accommodate it as best as you can, and you still have somebody who chooses an explicit war within Europe, then the population, as well as all other options, are exhausted such that you have no choice but to fight. And so I think that this was a similar situation with respect to NATO. And we pointed this out. Putin got what he wanted. Said he wanted. He got everything that he said that he wanted. And then he gives a speech where he casts himself as the next heir to the czar of all the Russias. And you're like, okay, dude, like that's what this is really about. And if you believe that, then I'm sorry, but then you're setting yourself up for a nuclear exchange. That's the truth. I mean, if you believe that Estonia, Lithuania, and all these, Latvia, are illegitimate countries, a la Ukraine, because remember, there's a reason he didn't start off with Ukraine. I did a whole monologue on this today about the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. He explicitly attacked the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk because it granted—
what that treaty was.
The Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, 1917, was a treaty signed by Lenin and Trotsky with the German Kaiser. It was the first historical acknowledgement of the independent states of Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, and Ukraine, as well as a few others. But those are the ones that mostly matter to the story. Now, from that point onward, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia were independent states from 1918 until 1939. Then they were taken over by the Soviet Union. But even then, after 1945, when they were codified to the Soviet Union, they were still admitted as independent districts/states, meaning that whenever they broke off from the Soviet Union, they retained their independence as an actual country, which they had never been before. So when Putin attacks and opens the speech, opens it, and I encourage you all, go and read the English translation. I did, the official English translation from the Kremlin on the Kremlin's website. He opens the speech by explicitly calling Lenin a fool and attacking the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in order to say that the treaty itself was illegitimate and thus that the countries that stem from it are illegitimate themselves. So now we're not talking about NATO. You're declaring NATO countries themselves to be illegitimate in the eyes of your regime, such that they are subject to the total control of the Russian Empire like they were in the days of the Tsar. And I'm sorry, we don't live in 1850 anymore. That's just not going to happen. We fought multiple wars in order to make sure that that isn't. And that is a huge threat to the balance of power, obviously, in Europe, the eyes of the world, etc. Some of these things just sound so cliche because, frankly, I think neocons and others have way overused them, such that whenever they really matter right now, it almost sounds cliche in order to say it, but, you know, this,
it's true.
It's never a thing. Right. Well, it's one of those things where, words do have meaning and they should be used in context. And this is the context that we're in. So anyway, this is a very long-winded way of saying that the Putin speech to me was very seminal and showing what this is all really about. And that's, again, I just can't get over it. I mean, he is risking Checkpoint Charlie level, eyeball to eyeball fights. For what? I just can't understand it.
Next question. Okay, let me get a good one. Okay, Conrad H. writes, "It feels like your realignment hypothesis from season one is actually being validated, but it's taking longer than expected. Curious if your take on that has changed at all. I saw a tweet from Eric Erickson to the effect of, I remember when the left was the Blame America First crowd. Interesting times." Yeah, look, like, I'll take this first. This is an interesting point because, Sagar, you and I have spent a lot of time this season talking about how we were wrong about a realignment of American politics that first season. To add the nuance that Conrad's question actually really gets at, we were wrong that in the short term there was going to be this populist economics, AOC joins with Josh Hawley on this very specific issue. That wasn't going to happen. The parties weren't going to realign that way. In many ways, COVID, we've talked about this separately off camera, COVID just pretty much reset people back to most of their same positions. Republicans talk about inflation a lot, hate deficit spending. Democrats talk about social spending, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the opposite of a realignment. But I just noticed on sociocultural issues, that is where the party realignment has happened. And in this case, we are seeing foreign policy disastrously, in my opinion, start falling on the realignment area. You see a lot of folks online. Once again, this is one of those areas where I don't want to overstate how big and legitimate they are, because they're not. A lot of these people are people who just sit on Twitter all day and post. They don't have any representatives who actually listen to them. They're not in elected office themselves, right? They just have, let's say, tens of thousands of Twitter followers. You see a lot of right-wingers tweeting things about America that, and American foreign policy, that are just incomprehensible to me and you as fourth graders when the right was talking about freedom fries.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Like, yeah. if you were to go to us during the lead up to the Iraq war, where people are saying the French are cowards, they won't invade. We're literally, by the way, for our younger listeners, because you all make your voices heard when we make weird references, freedom fries was when the house cafeteria literally renamed French fries freedom fries, the House in Congress, because French Jack Chirac, the president, would not support the war in Iraq. So to hear that, and then to hear plenty of people on the right basically say things like, well, you know, Putin's based, so, you know, like, who are we to like support it or Putin? I'm obviously referencing Steve Bannon here. It's been really the blame America first right has been a really depressing reality here, because I think the last thing this country wants, and this applies to our domestic politics, are right wingers who have fundamentally given up on the American project and have become nihilists. That never ends well.
I'm really sad about it too. At least in, and look, I'm not, as people know, I'm not the big, I'm not a Reagan lover. I'm not, you know, somebody who worships Reagan. I disagree with Reagan plenty, but at least we had Reagan in 1980. I mean, and I mean this from a dispositional way, in that what the country needed was not necessarily Reaganomics, but they did need a sunny guy who speaks confidently, who loved jelly beans. And that was really all it came down to in terms of the Reaganite appeal. And we don't have that. Instead, we have Trump. I mean, Trump is absolutely just a complete nihilist. He's an arsonist. These are all, once again, very tired takes. But to cheer on Putin for making Biden look weak, it's just like, dude, you're a sack of shit. Like, you know, it's just one of these things where, once again, everybody has overplayed this on cable, so it doesn't sound that shocking whenever I say it. But I think I hold my fire pretty well. So when you hear me say it, I'm just like, wow, like, you're a disgrace, man. Like, you're actually a disgrace. Whenever I say, and I, look, I'm not saying this matters. Look, most of the people who listen to this and who love Trump don't give a shit. And whatever, that's up to you. That's up, not between us. But like, I see Ron DeSantis, you know, take the CPAC stage right now, once again. And look, I'm not saying that he doesn't have the right to attack the president. I think everybody has the right to attack the president. But let's say one thing about the Ukraine invasion. You know, like, let's maybe just be like, just attack them a little bit instead of making everything about the culture war. I mean, you know, in World War II, Marshall, you know this from reading history, Republicans had plenty of beef with FDR, but they frankly could have waged campaigns which were far more critical of him, but decided not to, even though they were going to lose with Wendell Willkie. And the reason why that they didn't do that is because they thought that the project that America was fighting for abroad was so important that they were not willing to undermine the confidence of that in the electorate, even though FDR was eminently beatable in his fourth term, if they had wanted to try to pursue that. I mean, do you have any doubt that they wouldn't do the same, that they wouldn't take that course of action today? I know for a fact that they would. And that's, look, it's a sad thing. I know I sound like Joe Scarborough right now, which is
And this is, look, I talked about this. You listened to the episode with Dimitri, like, one of the worst things about our toxic politics is you and I feel bad for saying things that are true. Right? Yeah. Like, don't you get, I get a guilty when I'm like, right, oh man, was that just conventional wisdom about how we should treat each other with respect and actually consider the fact that we're fellow citizens? Man, that's cringe. This is a disaster. And I think you and I should actually be very self-critical when we have that instinct, because, dude, that's not you being Joe. I know you know this, but that's not you being Joe Scarborough. That's just you saying what words actually mean. It's really, once again, nothing profound there. It's genuinely bad. And there's just been a lot of really depressing mask off moments from people on the right over the past week, where it's very clear that you are unironically voting for America to fail. That just doesn't work. I get that you have serious beef with Biden. I get that you have beef with like the center left establishment, with the regime, to use the lingo. But if you are unable to separate that beef from the actual country that you nominally are supposed to not only reside in, but care about, then just get out of the system, get out of the game, because it will lead to nowhere but real disaster. So, next question. This comes from John S. He has two good ones I want to pick up here. One, are our leaders and Western allies knowledgeable about the history of Secretary of State James Baker's promise to Gorbachev after the collapse of the Berlin Wall? So Sagar, can you give us the historical context for what this question is referencing? And then we'll get into the back and forth on it.
Yeah, this was a verbal commitment from Baker during the collapse of the Soviet Union, in which he said that NATO would, quote, not expand one inch eastward. It was taken back and basically agreed to in words by President George H.W. Bush, at least in spirit, but was never put into writing, specifically because the U.S. didn't want to write itself into that. Russia plays that up to say that an absolute ironclad guarantee was given. Obviously, in the U.S. system, a single Secretary of State speaking with the authority of the president without codification in a U.S. Senate treaty is not actually the way that these things go. It's actually an interesting contrast, Marshall, to get to the difference between the Chinese and the U.S., Chinese, Russian, and the U.S. systems. The Chinese and the Russians take stuff that our officials say very seriously, whereas we all know those people are just elected/selected temporary officials, and the only thing that matters is a ratified treaty by the U.S. Senate in terms of what actually is going to get defended by the United States, 2/3 majority of the U.S. Senate. So it's just an interesting contrast between authoritarian systems where somebody legitimately can speak for the government and an elected democracy.
And this is, I think you set that up the right way, because look, like once again, I supported and frankly support even more up until now NATO expansion, given what just happened. You did not support, especially the Baltic admission.
No. Yeah.
But the key thing here that we can agree on, and I think we could agree on this, is James Baker, because this is what's interesting. In any other context, listeners who use this point, when John Kerry was Secretary of State, he could say all sorts of things.
And did.
To all sorts of people.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah.
That is not law, and that is not an agreement in the United States. Here's the key takeaway from this point. I could agree. I support NATO expansion. That said, I am deeply aware of the fact that countries like Georgia and Ukraine are clearly red lines for Putin. I wish, once again, this was not a formal extension of membership in 2008. I wish there was never even a conversation about letting Ukraine into NATO. That's clearly a red line here. So that is what I will concede. But that said, I think it's just total bullshit to give any good faith application of this argument to Russia. Putin was in the KGB, Gorbachev, Yeltsin, all these people. There's a sophisticated, just as the CIA does political analysis of other country, so does Russia. Russia knows how our system works. No one even remembers who James Baker was. There is not a single senator, congressman, mayor, garbage man who's elected in this country who thinks that they are in specific, that they have to stick to whatever James Baker said. That's just not how our system works. And it's a huge mistake, I think, when people indulge that fiction. I just see zero actual evidence that Putin or Gorbachev actually thought that was binding.
They didn't think it was binding. And I think that's
so why
that's
are people
fair.
Talking about it? Because it's ridiculous.
Well, just, I mean, because Putin does bring it up. And
because
look,
he's full
I mean,
of shit. But this is my point. Like, it's like, this is the key thing. What isn't full of shit? Russia is wary of NATO expansion. That is very clear.
Right. Yeah,
but
right.
This idea that they're offended and hurt by the fact that by the way, let's be clear here. George H.W. Bush was not even reelected. Right. So this is a near the end of the George H.W. Bush administration, verbal agreement, maybe kind of. That's insane. Like, that's like, you can't
even.
Yeah,
it's not
binding
whatsoever. No, it's yeah,
definitely true. And we should, and I just push, and John, once again, I you sent in good questions before, so I'm not dunking on you, but I just do not think we should at all buy into that frame. We should, though, have the discussion Sagar and I are having around, hey, how far into NATO is too far? Is it worth it? Is this a risk? That's fair language, but I think buying into bad frames is really bad. Second one, I'd love for you to explain this one, because you actually talked about this on Breaking Points. It was a good part of your monologue. Why was Putin's turn about in 2007 ignored? So give the context for that, and then we'll get into it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So people don't remember this, but Putin, for about the first decade of his reign, was seen as an ally of the West. Putin was the first person, foreign leader, in order to call George W. Bush. There was a Putin-Bush summit in November 2001 where Bush famously said he looked into his soul and saw that he was a trustworthy man. That worked out well. And actually, at that meeting, Putin even told him Ukraine is a fake country. So it's not like it hasn't been in his head all the way back since 2001. But anyway, Putin was seen as an ally against terrorism in particular, because Chechnya also has a big Islamic terrorism problem. Dagestan, obviously, the famous Tsarnaev brothers and all of that. And they were generally supportive of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, even though it was, you know, in their semi-sphere of influence. They backed us up in the U.N., all of that. The first break happened with 2003, the invasion of Iraq. But also during that period, people don't forget this, the full NATO expansion happened under the George W. Bush administration in 2002, with the Baltics officially being admitted into NATO. That was kind of a cross the Rubicon moment for Putin personally, but he wasn't able to get out of the fact that a large amount of Russians at the time did not feel deep animus towards the United States. Iraq changed all of that. Then Bush, deep on popularity and kind of the changing of the geopolitical situation, the weakening of America at the time, let kind of Putin fly his true colors. And in 2007, at the Munich Security Conference, he gives a speech which blows away the entire world. He castigates the West. He goes after NATO expansion. And it sets up the original harsh posture of the Putin that we see today. It's kind of interesting because that's the only Putin I've known in my adult lifetime. But it is important to know the history of how big of a shift that was, because he does it in the exact same room as, I think it was Robert Gates, who was the U.S. Secretary of Defense at the time. And everybody there can't believe their ears. This is a complete change in the posture of Europe. And then very next year, he invades Georgia during the 2008 Beijing Olympics. As you can see, history certainly rhymes quite well sometimes. So those two individual things happen at kind of the nadir of U.S. power and really of the European fractions with the United States and the NATO alliance, on top of the Baltic expansion, kind of set the stage for the Putin of where we are right now. It's kind of a fascinating history of a single man who's been in charge of the country for so long.
And here's what's wild. And I hear that story, and honestly, like, I'll just be real. I'm an interviewer, so I tend to want to avoid hardcore bias, but my honest hatred of Putin just gets even worse. Think of everything he, quote unquote, expressed and desired moving forward from the 2007 speech. Was there any more NATO expansion? No. Did Obama send troops into Ukraine in 2014? Did we send troops to back up Georgia in 2008? Georgia was one of the few countries, because I remember Fahrenheit 9/11 with Michael Moore. There was the joke about how a lot of the 40 countries that joined us in invading Iraq, it was mostly a joke. Like, Morocco even like offered to send specially, I'm butchering this, but like specially trained mine diffusing monkeys or something like that. But Georgia actually sent troops to Iraq. Georgia very much wants to be a part of the West, and this was a part of their campaign, frankly, to be admitted to the West, to enter into NATO, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Despite all of that, despite the fact that Georgians actually fought and bled with us in Iraq, regardless of what you feel about that war, we did not have their backs in 2008. So Putin got what he wanted. Biden didn't send troops in. Obama declined to intervene in Syria to the degree that he initially wanted to. If you actually just look at how events played out, over John McCain wasn't elected president. If you want to talk about a president, Mitt Romney wasn't elected president. Obama literally attacked the idea that Russia was an existential threat for the United States. Once again, Putin got every single thing he broadly wanted in that speech. He wanted a world that was more multipolar. He wanted a world where it wasn't just the U.S. dictating things top down like 2003. It is just wild to me to recount this history and say, holy shit, for good or for ill, the world looks way more like the world you expressed 2007 than it did look like the world of 2003. Yet you still invaded. That to me is insane.
Let me give the sad counter take that we also have to remember. It's a lot of it's George W. Bush's fault, man. I mean, none of this happens without the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the tarnishing of the American image abroad. It's fun to say, let's talk about Iraq, but we have to. I mean, at the end of the day, without the Iraq invasion, the Russian public never turns against the United States in the same way that they did after 2003. And that's ultimately what Putin was able to harness. Putin has always had this view. But the reason why he wasn't able to be anti-West from 1999 to 2007 is that the Russians broadly liked the United States. They liked Western culture. They liked, I mean, look, obviously capitalism and all that was generally a disaster for them. But even with the rise of oligarchs and all of that, it set the conditions where once the U.S. invasion of Iraq happens and the U.S. becomes, in the eyes of the world, I think legitimately at that time, a complete belligerent state, then it creates the conditions that Putin was able to domestically exploit for those purposes. So he's a bad person, no question. But unfortunately, because George W. Bush was our president, he set the tone for how we got here.
No, and once again, you know,
like we can't ever underestimate how bad Iraq was. It sounds trite, but it's true. Like it was so bad. Iraq, on so many levels. Like
Iraq obviously ruined. This seems trite, but Iraq actually ruined everything. Iraq destroyed George W. Bush's presidency. It really, I mean, look, like my biggest frustration during this entire debate was really the discourse around, oh, the CIA is always lying and the MIC. And I think so much of that's been just was total bullshit and was really just stupid. Look, we just did an episode on AOC. Like when AOC literally started off her hit with Mehdi Hassan by saying, well, we have to make sure the MIC doesn't make money off of this. I was just like, Jesus Christ, that has not aged well. And if you want to talk about why AOC can't speak for this generation, it's like that lack of just not being able to open with like empathy for the Ukrainian people, opening with, well, here's what I'm like, your number one concern here is how did this not turn nuclear in one direction? Or how do we actually make sure that Ukraine is safe? It has nothing to do with some clickbait about the MIC. But all that comes from Iraq.
And it resonates because of Iraq.
Yeah, no, I know.
There's a lot of people out there who will say, I'll never believe the U.S. intelligence ever again. And they shouldn't. I mean, in a lot of ways.
Let's talk about this. Because I don't want you to fall into traps here. It can't be that they shouldn't do. That's not sustainable.
Well, look, I don't know, Marshall. I mean, look, you know, they say the invasion will come on this day. And it's one of these things where...
Boy, that strategy, but dude, come on, dude. You know, like,
but
you
this guys, is look, what I'm like, getting
wait,
at.
Let me be frank. You guys didn't cover this side on Breaking Points much, but the argument for revealing that intelligence was Putin actually did plan on invading those days and it disrupted him.
Okay,
this is
possible,
how information
but
warfare
this is,
looks.
But that's possible. Here's the real question to you. 19 times out of 20 over the last 20 years, would you be better off betting against the U.S. intelligence or no? 19 out of 20.
In what scenarios?
In this Iraq scenario, even in previous warnings about what was going to become in the past, all of these seemed completely contrary and messaged towards something which was just not true. Under the Trump administration in particular, that was what really radicalized me personally in terms of a lot of these fake stories that I would see leaked to the media, Russian bounties, Afghanistan. I mean, it can go on forever. And Afghanistan
but once again,
but this is
black-pilling moment. But this is the pushback, and this came up in the Dimitri episode. I think what you just described, though, is an unsustainable level of cynicism. Because, dude, once again, all the tankies who get mad at you for being a China hawk, they're going to say, Sagar, you're lying. Like, all I'm just pushing back on you on is I do not think, look, Dimitri had good language around this. I think if we put out a clip, this would have been it. He said, We have to teach people that they need to be independent thinkers who can look at scenarios and make evaluations. Here's what I would say, the fairer version of what you're articulating. When the US government is making a argument for a war of choice in Iraq in 2003, man, let's be skeptical as hell. Let's probably not believe them. Let's bring that energy. But this was literally a situation where you had hundreds of thousands of Russians on the border. There was actually no, I think so many people, like honestly, yourself included, were transposing frustrations on a different scenario.
Well, let me be very clear once again. Nobody was doubting that the troops were there, but people were doubting when they say, oh, Russia's going to do this. Oh, Russia's going to do that. I've seen it. I've seen them say that 25 times before. I saw them put out absolute BS whenever it came to Afghanistan, try to cover their own ass for their own failures 20 years. Iraq is the same thing in terms of all these BS assessments, which were clearly influenced by politics, not to mention then the deep state leaks that follow in the Trump administration. I never doubted the facts. I doubted their assessments. I doubted and thought that there was a major political calculus towards some of the stuff that they were putting out. Now, I was wrong. I'm free to admit that. That being said, I think every single one of those biases and these skepticisms should be retained the next time that they make another claim. My default is not going to be... Sorry, go ahead.
Bias and skepticism are different than what you said a few minutes ago, which was like, we shouldn't believe the intelligence community.
I don't think you should default believe the intelligence community. That's what I'm saying. I do not think you should default believe them.
What, I guess... I don't understand, like...
I still believe that, yeah.
Here's what I basically just don't get. We're never doing an Iraq again. We're just not. It's like not. But seriously, like in terms of, I will stake a bunch of claims here. We are not going to launch a war of Iraq style thing for at least the next decade. That's just very clear to me. In a world where the CCP and Russia are authoritarian aggressors, this argument that because of MSNBC and the deep state and the war in Iraq, we have to default not trust intelligence agencies, that inherently helps them.
Okay, I agree. I agree and I accept that. But I don't think that they've earned our trust in order to do that. I'm fully I accept that.
You just set up a scenario where they could effectively never earn your trust because you are always going to say, well,
I mean, if they're right for the next 15 years, then okay, then you're going to come out on top.
When has history ever worked that way?
Well, like, that's my point. My point is that whenever you lose your credibility in the eyes of so many people, including myself, then it's on you in order to earn it back. Now, look, I'm going to be honest. They've got a little bit more of my credibility today than they did before, but that doesn't make and still will not change my default assumption that I generally don't believe a lot of their most maximalist claims that come out of the intelligence community. And look, I mean, I can still go on in terms of five things that they've gotten wrong in the last 2 years. I mean, lab leak is a huge one. And Josh Rogan has made this point. We have an $80 billion intelligence budget, and a lot of the stuff doesn't come out. I don't also trust the influence of a lot of social policy. Just yesterday, Marshall, we should do something on this. The Justice Department is closing its unit to go after Chinese espionage because of the concerns of woke activists. If you don't think that this stuff influences the intelligence community, I don't know what to tell you. So like, yeah, my assumption is going to be that those forces, which have corrupted everything else in American life, are generally going to corrupt their intelligence assessment and the claims that they are making going forward. I accept that unfortunately, that is a benefit to our adversaries. But it comes back to my Iraq point, which is nobody forced them to do it. They created the conditions under which this is possible. They don't have the trust. I mean, even today, if you were to put out a poll and ask somebody if they trust the CIA or whatever, they're going to say no. And this is the reason why.
This is what's tough here, right? Because look, Breaking Points gets a huge number of viewers because you have trust from your audience. How can they repair trust when you you just said the CIA, the FBI are infiltrated by wokeness. You are setting up a scenario where they could never, ever win back trust.
I didn't say that. I mean, look, if they stop putting out
videos about Latinx. You just said they are rotten to their core.
I didn't say they're rotten to their core. I said that they have deeply corrupting influences upon them, of which I think that most of the time when they're acting in the public, they're not doing so, A, in the interest of the public, or B, in good faith or accurately. So that's the problem. I mean, Marshall, this is my thing. And this is also why the skepticism and all of that is deeply, and I think correctly, rooted in these assessments. I mean, for example, let's go to this on Ukraine. Whenever they put out that statement about kill lists in Ukraine, the CIA and the intelligence community made sure to say that the people on the so-called kill list and all that were gay and trans activists. Maybe. But then whenever you see Putin, who actually talks about who are the people on the list, it's the people who had targeted Russian nationalists in a previous demonstration or whatever. I forget exactly what the context is. You don't think that that has something to do with social influence upon how exactly they view the Russian regime? By the way, I would deeply condemn any sort of rounding up or killing of gay trans activists within Russia. I think it's abhorrent. I think it's disgusting. And I think a lot of the way the gays are treated over there is crazy. What I'm saying is that those forces within these, I didn't say they're rotten to their core. I said that they have taken over this institution, just like every other institution in American life, which makes my default untrustworthy towards those people. If I see steps over the next decade through which that those began to get purged or no longer are the default through which they act in public life, then sure, I'll believe them again. But there's not a lot going on their side right now.
So because there are woke people,
it's not just woke. I'm giving you multiple examples.
Lab Leak is a great example. Your fundamental critique here is, unless these forces, which operationally means a combination of wokeness / MSNBC liberalism, are defeated or are pushed back, you're not going to take them seriously. I think what my concern is, and this will get to our next question, which is about Taiwan, the Chinese are going to be emboldened by this. And we need intelligence. We need assets. We need to make decision making. And I know you're not going to do this, but people are going to go around the gray zones of the world, the Tulsi Gabbards of the world, the Candace Owens of the world, some of the most cynical, frankly malign actors in our politics, say this is all a lie. This is the CIA. This is insert X, Y, and Z thing. That is going to fundamentally...
That's the price of living in a free society, Marshall. That's just the price of living in a free society. That's the price of living in a liberal, free, open society. They're grifters. They're liars. I can name a whole bunch of neocon people who misuse many of the talking points that you use to maximal political effect to try to crack down on domestic political opposition. That doesn't mean that I don't think that they shouldn't have the right to say it, nor would I ever try to tie you to those people. That's my point. We live in a frustrating, open, dynamic, open, liberal society. And that is the process through which it's going to play out. It's frustrating, but we don't live in authoritarian China. And ultimately, when institutions lack their trust, I think even though, and I just said, I recognized that it's actually of benefit to some of the worst actors of who I want to see diminished on the global stage. That being said, it is still incumbent upon us in order to make sure that we have institutions which restore trust within the public. And there's a lot more work to be done whenever it comes to that. Being right on Ukraine is not going to do that. So look, was I wrong? Yeah, 100%. I own it, no question, in terms of where my mistrust and all that put me on the wrong side of it. No, I don't stand by any of that, all of that. I'll give it to even my worst, most bad faith critics, the haters and the losers. That being said,
man, I've not heard that phrase in a long time.
The posture, I will defend the posture. And that's something that I think should continue.
So we'll hit the last two or three cues here. This one is actually from our researcher producer, Aaron Visser's grandmother, who is a avid reader of the Realignment Substack. Aaron, I'll prep this episode. Apologies, Carla. What could have been done to prevent this invasion and strengthen such fortify Ukraine? I'll give my answer real quick because it gets at the nuance. It gets at the nuance here. A thing that I think would have prevented, could have prevented the invasion would be if Biden had deployed US troops to Ukraine to act as a tripwire. This is what we did. So, sorry, one second. Liv, is there any way you could get her? Sorry, guys. Doggy's not cooperating. Basically, during the Cold War, we placed American troops in Berlin, in West Germany, and these were treated as tripwires.
Yeah, but those are NATO. Those are NATO.
Let me finish, though. Like, separate from the NATO, well, they were there before NATO was even a thing, too.
That's not true. In terms US of whenever it mattered against the Soviet Union, no, we had NATO. Well, no, but since
my point is, U.S. troops were in Germany before NATO like started as like an institution. That's all I'm saying here.
Sure.
Like the Berlin airlift happened before NATO. The Candy Bombers, 1949. Like there was, sure. There are very serious issues that happened before there was a NATO alliance in that sense. So all I am saying is something Biden could have done, which in a gambling sense could have prevented this conflict, is we are going to do what we did during the Cold War, which is place American troops in harm's way to create an incentive against an invasion. Yes, it was widely agreed by defense planners that the Soviets would easily roll over any American troops in Berlin and in West Germany. The reason why they didn't do that, for a variety of reasons, is the concern that, wait, if we kill American troops, yes, we defeat them on the battlefield that day, but what if this escalates? What if it goes nuclear? It's not worth it. Let's just draw the line at the Berlin Wall and the East German border, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Biden could have made that gamble. However, to the nuance here that we're getting into this episode, I still don't think that gamble would have been worth it in this case, given how far Putin is willing to push the button.
Yeah, I think that would have been crazy. Here's what would happen in that scenario.
Just to finish real quick, my point is just like the question of what could have been done. This is something that could have been done. And I think the reason why it was, let me put it this way. The only thing that I could, if you were to say gun to your head, Marshall, what would prevent Putin from invading? Given everything that's happened, I basically think it would have been a gamble on U.S. forces in Ukraine.
The only thing that would have worked is saying we're going to use nukes if you invade. That being said, here's what would have happened if you put U.S. troops there. Okay, then a bunch of the separatists from Donetsk and Luhansk are going to go and massacre U.S. forces. It would basically do the exact thing that happened from the Iranians to Americans via their Shia militia cutouts. They would just use stateless actors in order to make the American experience miserable. We'd have Black Hawk down times 10. It would be a huge military disaster. We would withdraw.
Putting U.S. troops in Kiev wouldn't have caused that.
Yeah, no, it absolutely would have. You think that the Russians would not have greenlit separatist attacks on U.S. forces?
I think if we occupied the separatist territories, I think yes.
No. If we put U.S. forces in Ukraine, which is an actual tripwire for the Russians and Russian security, then 100% they would have greenlit attacks by forces against U.S. convoys and all sorts of stuff. All of a sudden, these Eastern Ukrainian separatists would have had a fake excuse in order to go, and then wherever our bases is, mysteriously start exploding, and you're in for a five-year time occupation on top of some sorts of crazy military action. So no, I don't think it would have been worth it at all. It would have backfired tremendously from a domestic political... Look, Obama himself said this. I need to... My mouse isn't working, so I'm sorry. So I can't look this up. 2014, he was like, at the end of the day, Ukraine is a core security interest in Russia. It is not a core security interest to the United States. So I don't think it would have been worth it at all whatsoever to deploy a single U.S. force to the ground. And that's probably the only thing at this point, given what we know about the Putin speech and all of that, in order to stop this. And there's some humility in that. We live in a geopolitical age where people have nukes, and when people have nukes, they get a say in global affairs. I'm sorry, but that's just the truth. There's no way around it. This is why I was strongly for talking with Kim Jong-un for the same reason. He may be a genocidal madman. He may have killed a lot of people. The guy's got a nuke that can kill Los Angeles. That buys you a vote. That's just how it works.
Yeah, I think that. Because once again, the key thing is, I agree with you. I am just saying that from a pure, and it's kind of expresses how precarious this was. The only thing, because it's kind of interesting, because this is where like the Vietnam and the Afghanistan comparison becomes important. Even in the scenario you just described, Russian separatist attacks, that is still different than a full scale Russian invasion. So.
But then we leave and then they invade anyway. That's what I think. And by the way, us being there, they would have invaded.
But this is my point. And then it becomes a debate of like, well, then how long do you stay? Like, we're still in Germany, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All I just mean is that I wouldn't support placing U.S. troops there, but it's just an illustration of like, frankly, once that was off the table, the real answer was there was nothing that could stop this. Just at that point. Okay, so we're down to our last two questions. I'm sorry we couldn't hit everybody. We'll answer a few of these in different contexts, but this is from Steven. I would be interested in hearing what you think, what lessons from Iraq and Afghanistan are directly applicable to what happens moving forward.
Ooh, there's a lot. I feel like we just gave a ton. Here's mine. The follow-on effects of war, you should never underestimate them. From the impact of the immediate situation, your domestic situation, and for decades to come. If you had asked George W. Bush if he invaded Iraq in 2003, if it would lead to a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, he would have thought you were completely crazy. But guess what? Direct through line towards those two things. And I tweeted that this morning, actually, Marshall. That was my first response to Putin. I was like, you don't know what you've just done. You don't understand. When you invade a country, tripwire, war is a serious and it's a hellish thing. You can never, ever, ever underestimate how bad it can possibly be. Not even in terms of loss of life, economically, regime, the way that the world perceives you, and so much more. Willingly going into a foreign military adventure like this, I think you're the world's greatest fool.
Yeah, no, and I think my direct lesson would be one that, look, I know Biden looks terrible on stage and he looks sleepy and is not inspiring. This is not the Winston Churchill most of us would want. He literally said war of necessity, war of choice. That is the principal lesson from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. He understood this conflict through that framework. And let's be real here. We started the episode by talking about consensus. The consensus is, wow, like Putin actually is just a total bad faith actor who can't be taken seriously. Wow, like we're not going to roll back NATO. Wow, like there actually is this authoritarian threat to democracy and all these different topics. Hey, like we should, Europe, like Germany and Europe are now being serious about rearming for once. That happened because Biden at least got that first question right. And that is just so important. And I think that's like the real main lesson here. So last question before our takeout, and this is actually a really interesting one. Apologies, I lost it in the email here, but I'll be sure to reference you in the newsletter. The person said, quote, I've read that the Vietnam War was determined by television coverage, right? You could think of the example of Walter Cronkite saying that America lost after the Tet Offensive in 1968, once he turned against the war. So the questioner said, what does social media, what are the implications of social media in this context? And I think the main one here, I don't know about you, Sagar, but right before I was going to go to bed, I caught news of the invasion. I literally stayed up until 3 a.m. on Twitter, watching clips, watching Russian jets get blown out of the sky, watching missiles just like go into people's houses. Like, you know, we talked about, we've seen, like, we've like unironically, once again, a word that's cringe, but means something. We've lived privileged ass Western podcaster lives. Like, I've seen so many like dead bodies. I see, like, you know, the first Ukrainian who died is our age. He was a lieutenant, and he's dead. These images mean that Putin has no leeway whatsoever. Even during the war in Iraq, there was this weird period where people gave the U.S. the benefit of the doubt. The way that you were talking about
cable,
it is
cable yeah, wouldn't
even,
show it
even
too.
Cable right. until
the insurgency really until, started.
Yeah, so it was three things. So one, it was disbanding the army and government, and the Ba'ath Party, which led to all of the looting, and then you had the insurgency. And you had like Abu Ghraib and like the pictures of Jessica England literally torturing people. There was this year period before that even happened, right? Like the entire, you know this, right? Like the entire invasion happened and there wasn't that much, even in the US, backlash, right? Now, Putin had zero opportunity to come out looking like a reasonable person. The second that you see a video of a SU-35 or SU-37, apologies for not being great on my Russian military aircraft, but I get, depressingly, I'm guessing we're going to get quite better at this. Once you see a missile getting launched into a kid's home, it's just over. There's just no, and this is why, it's like you said, dude, this is why Putin screwed this up so badly. Because basically, here's the take here. In today's environment, you cannot launch a war like this and expect sympathy, expect coming out ahead. I mean, my final question will be, where do we go from here? But I just do not see a world where Russia is just not an actual pariah state for as long as Putin is still alive. But what's your answer to the social media question?
It's the same one. It's simple. You know who found this out was Assad. He may have won, but he'll never be welcome back into the world community ever again, right?
Because it was worth it for him because he was going to get, like,
it was worth it for him
because
he would literally be shot in the head if he lost. But, like, he had to kill 550,000 people in order to make that, something like that, I forget. Aleppo, killing kids, all of that. He's staying in Syria for the rest of his freaking life. North Korea is really the same way. And now Putin has decided to join their ranks. That's the part I really don't get. Also, if I'm a Russian oligarch, I'm pissed, man. I mean, I just got all my stuff in London taken. I got my yacht, apparently, is parked in Monaco.
Your kid can't go to college in the U.S. anymore.
Kids can't go to college. You know, I feel really, I was telling you, I feel really bad for young Russians. A lot of these people, they didn't grow up with this, and they never wanted this. A lot of them are out right now in the streets, protesting in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, we have to talk about them.
Yeah, I feel bad for them. I feel terrible for them. Their lives are ruined. It's over. They'll never be able to leave their country. He just bought them a Soviet Union, but shittier, because at least that was an empire.
At least they went into...
I make jokes about this. You know, the Russians get beat by Italy in terms of GDP. That takes skill to be that bad of a domestic economy. A lot of these people who are young and our age, they grew up on the internet. They're not westernized per se, but like they're more global.
Let me put it this way.
Yeah.
A young British kid doesn't care about returning to the glory of the British Empire. Right. If you're a young Russian,
you don't give a fuck.
Right. Apologies, Carla. You don't give a fuck about the glory of the 19th century.
Yeah. Correct.
And it sucks that an old man, let me put it this way. It's funny. This is, and sorry, and I'll get back to your point, but it's funny. People talk about, oh, Biden's like old and it's so depressing. At least Joe Biden, because of our system, is not capable of him. Like, what do you think? Ooh, this is a question. What year do you think Joe Biden's favorite year in America? I know his family died, so it's difficult. What do you think Joe Biden thought peak America was? You know?
I don't know. Probably like, what, like, 85, something like that.
Something, because the other thing is he's gearing up to run for. What if Joe Biden could unilaterally just say, you know what? America is going back to 1985, and every decision we're going to do is going to go through that lens. He can't do that under our system. Right. Putin has just, this is so, thank you for bringing up the part. Putin has just done this to our generation in Russia. And
that sucks. I feel terrible for them. You know, there's a lot of Russians who are starting businesses, consider themselves much more European, who, coming here for the United States, across the West, their lives are over, man. I mean, over. And I mean, that's bad for them. It's just like I feel like I'm in the 1980s right now. This is how a lot of guys used to talk about some of the young talent in the Soviet Union. I feel exactly the same way, which is that research grants, scientific achievement, all of that, you're now confined to, frankly, like we said, a shittier version of the Soviet Union. That sucks. He's condemned his own population for his own mistakes, but that's what it means to live in an authoritarian system. I feel bad for Ukraine. I feel bad for Russians too. I know it's not necessarily the plight or the PC thing or whatever to say, but I can understand that even the older people and all that very much support Putin, but I don't think a lot of these young folks do. And if they do, they're going to find out real hard what the price of that is. I feel bad for them.
So for our final just takeout here. All right, man, what's next? What do you think? What not a prediction, because predictions suck. Like what is the Sagar and Jetty moving forward look like? And we'll cover this topic with a bunch of guests in the coming weeks, but I just want to get your take on it. And I'll get fine.
I don't know. I mean, to me, we're just living in a whole new age. I hate to say it, it's kind of exciting, but it's exciting only in the idea that, like, it's crazy. You know, people are literally dying. And everything feels up for grabs. It's a good thing and it's a bad thing. Everything is changing. Europe is going to come back. I think Europe coming back is the undertold story. That's what I kept saying on the show. I think Putin has awoken a sleeping giant in terms of Germany, France, and the UK. A total return to the era of great power politics on the continent is going to change things in a way that we never knew before. It just feels like everything, we're entering a whole new age. And that's sad, but it's interesting. So there's that.
You know, your reference to exciting times brought to mind that one of my, I've had a variety of cringy media appearances, but I just searched Marshall Kozlov 2014, The Oregonian. I was featured in a paper and in a piece by Steve Dean, and I'll read you the quote. It's really bad, considering.
Yeah, what is it?
Once these senators start retiring, once people my age start getting into power, a lot of these issues will be resolved, he argues. Most people my age agree there's a role for government or society. Universal health care, there's a legitimate debate, but most agree that gay marriage is way on to becoming the law of the land. That's not what myself and other people who seek elective office will be debating. I think it's a challenge. I think we're living in interesting times. I think it will be exciting when the Social Security Trust Fund runs out, when the baby boomers retire, when the debt's too high and you can't pay for anything. When we're forced, in other words, to rise above the scorched earth. That was Steve Dean's editorializing, and I close with this. That will be an amazing place to be. And I'd much rather worry about that than getting a job as an associate at a law firm.
Wasn't wrong, you know?
I guess let me put it this way. Now that I'm actually, I said this almost 10 years ago. I'll link this in the show notes. 2014 was so boring, man. That's where I'm actually really getting at. 2014 was so boring. And I think the reason why I'm cringing isn't that my analysis was that off. It's that, like, exciting times are terrible, and actually exciting times mean that hundreds of people died last night and died today. And that is something that, but this is the key thing. In my sentence, I didn't mention a single foreign policy thing. Mm-hmm. I did not think that 2014, crazy times. So look, just to close this out on what my forward looks like, look, like, NATO is not getting rolled back. Defense spending is going to go up in the US and abroad
a lot.
I wouldn't feel secure if I were Taiwan, but even what's crazy is even in that case, if the CCP were to invade, that would only drive further.
I was going to say, Marshall, I think it's a net negative for Taiwan, actually. I mean, for China. On this front, I think that the brazenness and the fierceness which with the West has responded, at least in rhetoric so far, I know all these journalists are crying about SWIFT. Look, this shit is irrelevant. Russia is now a pariah state for a generation. I don't think China wants that. And I think that they're seeing this very clearly about how this is playing out on the world stage and the about face. When Germany hits the Nord Stream pipeline, that's when you knew shit was crazy. That was not something I think that China or Russia ever expected. For Germany, which gets 50% of some of its imports from Russia, to cut it, I think that if I'm China and I'm looking at this, Taiwan's not worth it. So that's just my take. Maybe I'm completely wrong.
Here's hoping. Well, everyone, this has been our first actual unfiltered emergency podcast. Hope you all enjoy it. Would love you guys to get in the comments, send us emails. We're sending out the newsletter regularly, so lots of great stuff there. And of course, let's just close with a word for both the people of Ukraine who are really suffering right now without us being able to do much about it, and then also brave Russians who are standing up and protesting when that is completely forbidden, and they're taking a real risk there. So that's where we'll close. Any last words, Sagar?
No, that's it. I'm definitely thinking about those people. That takes guts to go out there and do that.
Good show. All right. See y'all next time. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.